This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest one of all?
That's the Wicked Queen in Walt Disney's 1937 classic Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the first feature-length animated film. My guest Neil Gabler has written a new book about Disney and how he reshaped our popular culture and the American consciousness. Disney reinvented animation with characters like Mickey Mouse, and with Disneyland, reconceptualized the amusement park as theme park. He recognized the importance of television at its start with the Mickey Mouse Club and helped bring color to TV through his program, The Wonderful World of Color. While many of his movies offered a nostalgic view of history, Disney also looked to the future with Tomorrowland and Epcot. My guest Neil Gabler is also the author of the books Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity, and An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. I told Gabler that I was surprised to read in his new book that despite Disney's many successes, several of his early animated classics originally lost money.
Yes, that was surprising to me, too. I just assumed when I embarked on this project that, you know, all of these films were enormously successful and the money was just pouring in. And in point of fact, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was enormously successful. It brought so much money to the studio that he was actually able to build a new studio in Burbank, California, where Walt Disney Productions is still headquartered. But after Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, film after film after film lost money, and rather than bring enormous amounts of money into the studio, they poured enormous amounts of money out of the studio. Pinocchio was a disaster. Fantasia, an even bigger disaster. Bambi was a disaster. The only one of that run of films that we regard now as the classic Disney animations that made any money was Dumbo, and that made money because it was done very cheaply. It was much less expensive than the other animations. It was produced for roughly $600,000, and that was done intentionally because the studio desperately needed an inexpensive film that they could get some kind of profitable return on, and Dumbo happened to do that. But then from Bambi to Cinderella, you know, there were no feature animations made because the studio simply could not afford to do them. And there was an awfully long period of time where the studio said, you know, we can't make feature animations. We're just going to have to end that whole idea of making feature animations because there is no way, given how labor-intensive these films are, that one could finally make a profit on them.
But I guess once the baby boom generation was born and started going to the movies, those old movies started to make a profit.
Yes, well, Walt always thought, it's funny, Terry, he always said, you know, I don't care if these movies make a profit now. And he really meant that. He didn't care. Walt had a very kind of cavalier attitude towards money. He said, but these films will eventually make a lot of money. You'll see. We'll re-release them. That was always an intention of his, to re-release the films. You know, it worked out that he re-released them every 7 years. And then they also, you know, exploited the television potential of those films when he had the Disneyland series. But he always thought, in the long run, they'll make money. And that was a characteristic of Walt. Walt never thought short term. He was always thinking long term. It was always about the looking to the horizon and not at, you know, what was directly in front of you.
Walt Disney in the 50s, you know, Uncle Walt is as a lot of people grew up knowing him, had a very conservative image. As you describe it in the book, he was the personification of traditional values and square aesthetics. And yet earlier in the book, you say when he came to Hollywood, he loved dress up and make believe. He was boisterous, outgoing, self-aggrandizing, histrionic. So was the conservative image just part of his, like another costume for him, or was he really that conservative deep down?
In some ways, it was a costume. I mean, the early Walt Disney, I think, as you very accurately portray it, was flamboyant. I mean, he was an innovator. He was a subversive. The early Mickey Mouse cartoons, you know, were clearly patterned after Charlie Chaplin's comedies. And little Mickey Mouse was a kind of a scamp. I mean, he was a subversive. He was a guy who was always poking and prodding and pulling and defying authority. And Walt was kind of that way, too, at least artistically speaking. And it was one of the ways that he gained an enormous artistic cachet in the 1930s. I mean, intellectuals loved Walt Disney because they saw him as this naive, artless artist. This guy who wasn't, you know, all full of pretension. He was completely unpretentious. There was a really plebeian quality to Walt Disney. Now, as time went on and he became more successful, in some ways he became a victim of his success. He became kind of the image of America to much of the world, and Walt began to take that seriously. He understood that he was being imprisoned by that image. Walt never fooled himself that he was really Walt Disney. And in point of fact, that is the Walt Disney that you described, the avuncular Walt Disney. And he actually had said, you know, I'm not Walt Disney. You know, Walt Disney is a thing.
Well, you know, in talking about what Walt Disney's personality really was like, you describe him as very obsessive, driven, and often unhappy.
Yes.
We had two breakdowns. What were they about?
Well, the first breakdown, which he himself has described in a series of interviews that he gave to his daughter and which were later put into a book called The Story of Walt Disney, happened in the early 1930s when he was making the Mickey Mouse cartoons. And he found himself unaccountably crying all the time, unable to sleep, desperately unhappy, deep, deep depression. And he attributed it finally to the fact that the Mickey Mouse animations were never as good on screen as they were when he imagined them in his head. And he just couldn't tolerate that. Now, the second breakdown happened in the post-war period when, again, having made these great, you know, feature animations, he came to the conclusion that he could never make animations that were anywhere near as good as the golden age of animations, the films that he made during that golden age, the Snow Whites, Pinocchio, Dumbo, whatever, that they're simply financially that wasn't viable anymore. And the form that this sort of breakdown took was that he retreated and he became obsessed, not with a studio, not with animations, but with model trains. He built model trains. He would actually go to the machine shop of the studio and build these trains. He laid track around his house and would put on an engineer's cap and ride the trains. He was just absolutely, completely, 24/7 absorbed by model trains.
Well, you did use the word obsessive.
That he was.
Why did Disney develop an animation studio? Had he been an animator himself before creating his own studio?
No, he was an artist, a commercial artist. And interestingly, he formed the studio when he was very, very young. You know, Walt Disney died when he was only 65 years old. And most of his accomplishments happened when he was a very young man. So he was living in Kansas City, working at a studio that made animated advertisements to be shown before motion pictures. And this was in the early 1920s. And he became so absorbed, as always, with making these, with drawing these animations, that he decided he wanted to draw longer ones. And that ultimately expanded into his quitting his job and forming, at the age of 20 years old, his own animation studio in Kansas City. And he signed on young men who also had an interest in animation, and what he offered was they would learn how to do this together. So that was his very first animation studio. Now, that animation studio didn't last very long. He signed a very poor contract. The company with which he signed the contract ultimately went bankrupt, and his own company, which was called Laugh-O-Gram Films, also went bankrupt. And so that ultimately was the spur for his going to Hollywood.
You know, in talking about his, like, Disney's sense of wanting perfection in the world yet being unable to achieve it, I'm reminded, of course, of Disneyland. And, you know, one of the ways you describe Disney in your book is as being, along with Norman Rockwell, the leading avatar of small-town flag-waving America. And, you know, he invented the theme park, he invented Disneyland. And Disneyland is this combination of fantasy in the rides and this kind of, like, idealized small-town America in its streets. Did that vision of, like, Disneyland connect to anything in his childhood? Did he actually have an idealized hometown like that?
Yes, he did. I mean, he came by that Disneyland vision, particularly the Main Street that is the entrance to Disneyland and to Walt Disney World as well. He came by that very honestly because when he was very young, he was born in Chicago. but his parents moved when he was a very young boy to a small farm community called Marceline in Missouri. And Walt Disney, throughout his entire life, though he only lived there for 5 years, throughout his entire life, he always regarded Marceline, Missouri as kind of the touchstone. That was the idol of his life. That was where he had his best times. That was the place, he later said, that had more to do with shaping him than any other community. And, you know, I don't want to be Freudian about this or overly psychological about it, but I think one could certainly make the case that throughout his life, Walt Disney was always trying to find some way back to the security, the beauty, the enjoyment that he had in Marceline, Missouri.
God, I hear you talk about this, and I'm thinking Rosebud.
Oh, yes.
I'm thinking Susan Cain.
Marceline is the Rosebud of Walt Disney's life.
We have a lot of interesting information about the creation of Disneyland in your book. And you say that, you know, Disney saw it as kind of like a series of cute movie sets, and some of it was built on like a three-quarter scale. So everything was three-quarters of the size that it would have been in real life. Why did he do that?
We did it for a number of reasons, but one of the most interesting reasons to me is Walt Disney really abhorred the notion of monumentalism. And he actually, you know, talked about, you know, Nazi monuments that were always oversized and that, you know, he thought, you know, kind of dwarfed people. And what he wanted to do was empower people. So he thought, you know, if you make a theme park that is actually a smaller scale, not only will people feel that it's kind of a toy, and there's something fanciful about it because it's smaller, but they will also feel empowered. And Disneyland has an awful lot to do, as does all of Walt Disney's work, as a matter of fact, with this notion of empowerment.
My guest is Neil Gabler. His new book is called Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Neil Gabler, and his new book is a biography of Walt Disney. One of Disney's greatest legacies is, of course, Mickey Mouse. And, you know, he helps to create Mickey Mouse very early in his career. And, of course, Mickey Mouse still survives today. And, you know, there's the Mickey Mouse Club. There's marketing around the world of Mickey Mouse things. So let's just begin with the creation of Mickey Mouse. Like, who were the brains behind it?
Well, there were really two brains behind Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse happened because Walt Disney created another character, Oswald the Rabbit, and had that character taken away from him by Universal Pictures, who was the distributor of his animations. And he had a showdown with his distributor in New York, lost that showdown, and was on a train ride back to California and realized he had nothing. Not only had the character been taken away from him, but the distributor had also hired away most of his animators behind his back. So now Walt Disney was in the position of having to start from scratch. And on that train ride, as the story goes, you know, he said he came up with the idea of a mouse as a character and actually even wrote a brief scenario and brought that back to Los Angeles with him. That's one story. Ub Iwerks, who was Walt Disney's chief animator at that time and a longtime collaborator with Walt going all the way back to Kansas City, told a different story. He was a man of few words, but in one interview, he said, that's really not the way it happened. What happened was that Walt got back from New York. We sat around and tried to determine what kind of character might work on screen. Cats had already been done. Obviously, they'd had a rabbit prior to this period. So they hit upon doing a mouse, which was patterned after a mice that had been drawn by an artist by the name of Clifford Meek, who was wrote for humor magazines or drew pictures for humor magazines. I think the interesting thing about the early Mickey Mouse is that Mickey Mouse is really bipolar. On the one hand, Walt Disney always saw Mickey Mouse as being a kind of Charlie Chaplin figure, as I said earlier, and Ub Iwerks saw him as a kind of Douglas Fairbanks figure. So almost from his inception, Mickey Mouse was kind of oscillating between these two sides, the heroic Douglas Fairbanks side and the impish Charlie Chaplin side. And in fact, I don't think he was ever able to resolve those two very disparate halves of himself. And it was one of the elements, among many, that contributed to his demise. Because though you say, you know, well, Mickey Mouse still exists, and he does still exist, he exists now essentially as a corporate logo, mm-hmm. as an image. Mm-hmm. But he does not exist as a character.
No, as you say in your book, through Disney, you can see the interplay of art and commerce in America. And you could certainly see that through Mickey Mouse, because as you say, Mickey Mouse became like a logo for the Disney company and has been marketed in every way imaginable and synergized, you know, the Mickey Mouse Club on TV, Mickey Mouse in the theme parks. Who was behind that? You described someone named Herman K. Kamen,
yes,
as being the merchandising genius of
He was the merchandising Disney. Genius. I mean, the very first Walt Mickey Mouse product was a paper tablet with Mickey Mouse's picture on it. And Walt, I think, got paid $300 for that when he was in a New York hotel. And somebody came up to him and said, you know, I'd like to put Mickey Mouse's image on this tablet and I'll give you a little bit of money for it. But Walt had already been looking at the enormous merchandising that surrounded Felix the Cat, who was the preeminent animation figure before Mickey Mouse. And he wanted to get a part of that swag himself. And the way he got it was by calling a man by the name of Herman K. Kamen, who had a business that essentially conducted department store promotions. Kamen immediately came to Los Angeles. He was based in Kansas City, Walt's old hometown, and said, I can make you a lot of money with Mickey Mouse. And that's exactly what he did. And that association lasted for 17 years until Kay Kamen died in an airplane accident. And he made enormous amounts of money, operating on somewhat the same principle that Walt Disney did. That is, finding partners, merchandising partners, who were very high quality, very upscale, who wouldn't compromise the quality of the Mickey Mouse product, which is exactly how Walt saw his own animations. And, you know, they reaped tremendous, tremendous profits. At times, much more from the merchandise than they were getting from the films themselves. That is, the Mickey Mouse shorts themselves.
One of Disney's geniuses was getting into television when television was still really young and getting a real foothold there. So he did well with his programs. That helped with the merchandising of his products. That helped sell his movies. I mean, it just helped in every way.
Yes.
Why did he have faith in television at a time, I think, when a lot of people didn't?
You know, Walt, for all the small-town 19th-century qualities that he had and all those 19th-century values that he seemed to purvey, he was also, oddly enough and seemingly contradictorily, you know, a very visionary figure who loved technology, promoted space on his Disneyland television series. But what happened with Disneyland was that, I mean, Walt had long had an interest in television. And actually, at one point, it pondered buying television stations in the post-war period. But when he came to build Disneyland, or wanted to build Disneyland, he had one major problem, a problem that had dogged him essentially all of his life, surprisingly. He had no money. Walt Disney needed money. And all the time he had planned the park, he really hadn't given a great deal of thought to how he was going to finance the park. And it was an enormous venture, you know, even in those days, and required enormous amounts of capital, some $17 million. And the plan that he hit upon to finance the theme park was he was going to sign a deal, which he ultimately did, with ABC, which was the third of the major networks and which desperately needed programming. And as part of that deal, he agreed to do a television series, which ABC believed would be enormously successful. They were right. It was a ratings champion. But ABC also agreed to put a fairly large stake in the theme park and to underwrite loans to the theme park. So Walt Disney exchanged the television series for financing for the theme park. And in point of fact, you know, each individual episode of the show lost enormous amounts of money, just as the feature animations did, with the exception of Snow White. But he understood that the television show was a great promotional vehicle both for the theme park and for the feature animations. It was like getting an hour commercial for both, you know, every week.
You tell a lot of interesting stories about the creation of the Mickey Mouse Club. You say that Walt Disney wanted kids on that show who looked like real kids. He didn't want professional actors. He wanted the kids to be cast from schoolyards. Did it actually work out
that way? Yes, it did. Actually, he sent, you know, Bill Walsh, who was the producer of the show, to schoolyards, and he said, this is what you've got to do. I don't want all these professional kids, you know, these kids who can all tap dance and have bright smiles and Shirley Temple hair. I don't want that. Go to a schoolyard and watch the kids who kind of everybody gravitates around. You'll see who has charisma. We can teach them all of these talent skills, but essentially, you can't teach charisma. And that is how they went and recruited a lot of the kids. These kids were not all, you know, professionals with professional smiles and professional talents. They taught them those things.
Neil Gabler is the author of the new book, Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Neil Gabler, author of the new book, Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. In addition to having written several earlier books about movies and American popular culture, Gabler is a regular panelist on the Fox News program Fox News Watch. It features two liberals and two conservatives commenting on the media. Gabler is one of the liberals. Walt Disney is such a key figure in American popular culture. One of the chapters of his life that you explore in the TV was his testimony before HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, during the anti-communist hunting era. Why did he testify before HUAC at a time when some people declined to testify or to name names? Why did he testify and what did he have to say?
You know, I'd said that he was non-ideological, and I think that's absolutely true. But in 1941, the studio, the Burbank studio that he had built on the proceeds of Snow White, and which he tried to make into a workers' paradise, a utopia, that studio was struck by the Screen Cartoonists Guild. It was a very bitter strike, even more bitter because Walt had a very paternalistic attitude and thought, you know, here I created this paradise on earth, and I'd worked with all of these people for years, and we had this wonderful camaraderie, and now they've destroyed everything. The strike lasted from May until September, when it was finally settled, not on terms favorable to Walt. In fact, the National Labor Reconciliation Board essentially forced Walt to settle. But Walt always felt, and this was really his kind of political baptism, Walt had always felt that the strike had been instigated by communists who were out to get Walt Disney, in part because he was a representative of American culture. And that animus never left him. Now, he wasn't entirely, paranoid. There were communists deeply involved in the union. And it may have actually been the case that the union was out to get Walt Disney. But in any case, in the post-war period, when Walt was called to testify, he happily did so, really on the basis that, you know, he was getting back at the people who had destroyed everything he had built. So he was angry. And when he testified, though he wasn't quite as virulent in his denunciations as some of those who testified, nevertheless, I mean, he did tell the committee that he believed that communists had instigated the strike and tried to destroy his studio, and that Herbert Sorrell, who was the head of the union, had said that, or head of the umbrella to which the union belonged, the umbrella group, said that he was going to turn the Disney studio into a dust bowl. That was part of Disney's testimony that day.
Did he name names beyond the head of the union?
No, he did not. No, because, you know, ultimately, he had no basis for accusing anybody of anything, since, you know, the person who he hated most was Art Babbitt, who was a longtime animator. Actually, he had animated the Mushrooms in Fantasia. And Art Babbitt had taken on to head the union at the Disney studio. But as much as Walt Disney hated Art Babbitt, you know, no one could have really made the accusation that Art Babbitt was a communist, and he wasn't. So he really didn't name names except in misspeaking. And he misspoke by accusing the League of Women Voters of being a communist front that had attacked him during the strike. And it was very hard for him to pull back from that. He kept on insisting afterwards that the League of Women Voters had somehow conspired to destroy the studio, when it turned out it was another organization called the League of Women Shoppers. And Walt finally was forced to say, no, it wasn't the League of Women Voters, it was the League of Women Shoppers, and I apologize.
Neil, can you tell us something wonderful and surprising that you found in the Disney archive while doing research for the book?
You know what? There's no smoking gun in this book, in the sense that you're gonna find, oh, Walt Disney was gay. I didn't know that, or you know, that's not gonna happen. And I know I'll probably disappoint some readers, because I like to think that the entire life is a revelation. You know, I think, you know, his relationship with his family is somewhat interesting, because you know, Walt, being a perfectionist and being someone who is obsessed with his studio, spent a lot more time at his studio than he ever spent with his family. And a very testy relationship with his wife. I mean, one of the surprises for me is that the individual who seemed to believe least in Walt Disney's visions, the individual who told him, nobody will see dwarves, dwarves are ugly, they'll be put off by dwarves, the person who told him, why in the world do you want to build Disneyland? What in the world are you thinking? Who's going to go to a theme park? That individual was his wife. And as Walt said to one individual, one employee who came to him asking for more money because he said his wife told him they needed more money, Walt said, your wife? Do you know where I would be if I listened to my wife? He was right, by the way.
One more question. You used to be a film critic. And,
yes, I was.
I'm sure you went back and watched all of the Disney movies and probably a lot TV shows, too. What did you see that you had never noticed before? Is there one cartoon or one show or movie that you saw very differently now than you did when you saw it when you were younger, or when you saw it when you were a young man, before you were researching Disney in depth like this?
Well, I'll tell you, I was somewhat surprised in watching Pollyanna. Again, Pollyanna has a very kind of caustic streak in it about small-town values, small-town hypocrisy. It promotes progressive values. It takes on religion. And that's somewhat surprising when one thinks of Walt Disney. And another thing that, I didn't surprise me, but that I felt more strongly on what must have been my 10th viewing of the film, was what an amazing achievement Pinocchio is. You know, I don't make value judgments in the book about the quality of the films, but, you watch Pinocchio, which is a film of such great sophistication, a film that is so dark in so many ways, betraying the image of Walt Disney as being the master of lightness. That is a film that just, continues to astonish me, and astonished me again, watching it as I was researching the book.
Yeah, and you say that Disney suggested the idea of Jiminy Cricket as Pinocchio's conscience because he thought Pinocchio was maybe too dark.
Yes, I mean, the problem with Pinocchio was, how is anybody going to like this puppet? This puppet is mean, and this puppet is easily, moved to do things that, a hero of a film doesn't do. And it was Walt who finally said, we're going to take that cricket figure who exists in the book, and Walt is and whom Pinocchio actually stomps upon. We're going to take that figure and we're going to turn him into the conscience. So he's constantly reminding Pinocchio of what Pinocchio ought to be doing. Well, of course, that innovation is the innovation that makes the entire film, cohere. And by the way, I should add that that kind of innovation that Walt came up with was not atypical. That was actually fairly typical of what Walt contributed to the films. When one thinks of Walt Disney today, one may think that, well, he was just a kind of a name who supervised everything, but the real work was done by the animators. And in point of fact, when you look at those early animations, you see that Walt was involved in almost every frame of the film. Every single frame was the product of Walt Disney's mind, of Walt Disney's vision.
Neil Gabler, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for asking me. I really appreciate it.
Neil Gabler's new biography is called Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination.